Welcome to the Deep Dive. You know, this is where we take those sources you find interesting, the ones you send our way, and we really pull out the key stuff, the things that matter.
Exactly. And today we're focusing on episode 63 from Military Tales on YouTube.
Right. Someone sent this one in, and it's quite something. It's a firsthand account from Thomas Allen Dwell.
Yeah, Tom Dwell, if you really want to understand what air combat, specifically close air support, was like in Vietnam, his story is, well, essential listening, I'd say.
Absolutely. He was born back in 1937, so, you know, he was 82 when this was recorded. And apparently still flying.
Still flying. Even after, I mean, he had a serious accident later, lost part of his hand. Incredible dedication.
It really is. He flew the F-100 Super Sabre.
Yeah.
270 combat missions in Vietnam. Ended his career as a lieutenant colonel.
And that experience in the F-100 doing close air support, that's really the core of what makes this source so powerful, isn't it?
Totally. We're going to get into the tactics they use, which were, frankly, incredibly daring. The teamwork, the camaraderie between the pilots.
And even a bit about his life after the war. He got into air racing, had a family business. It's a full picture.
So the goal here is to give you a real sense, almost a visceral feel for close air support in Vietnam, you know, straight from someone who lived it. Okay, let's get into it.
Right. So a little background first. Dwell, born August 5th, 1937, he did his initial training, F-100 training, at Hurlburt Field in 64.
Okay, Hurlburt. And then deployed to Vietnam pretty quickly after that.
Yeah, February 1965, he arrived as a first lieutenant. So this is right when the major American buildup is really kicking off.
Mid-60s, yeah. A critical time. And he talks about being put on alert almost straight away, right, for troops in contact.
Troops in contact, yeah. That phrase itself just tells you everything, doesn't it? It means friendly forces are engaged, they're in trouble, often getting hammered.
Urgent. Life or death stuff.
Definitely. And Dwell really emphasizes how often these alerts came at night. And especially when the weather was bad.
Yeah, he mentioned something about the F-100 specifically, didn't he? Called them attack hard killers.
That's right. He said they were kind of unique because they could fly those night missions in terrible weather when maybe other aircraft couldn't or wouldn't.
So they were filling a critical gap.
Absolutely vital. He puts it very bluntly. They were saving cities, villages, special forces camps, fire bases, places that were about to be overrun. He says they were going to die if we didn't help them. Just like that.
Wow. That puts the pressure on. It really highlights that reliance, that trust between the guys on the ground and the pilots.
Immense trust, pushing the limits constantly. He even calls the Battle of Dong Zhuai the best battle he was ever in. Gives you a sense of the impact they felt they were having.
Okay, so Dong Zhuai. But he gives a really detailed example of another mission, right? Okay. To really illustrate what it was like.
He does, a really vivid one. It was a night mission supporting the 25th Infantry Division near Quinon.
Right, and what was the situation on the ground?
An ambush. A convoy was moving along a dike, a raised road, basically, and they got hit. RPGs took out vehicles at the front and the back, trapped them.
Oh, man. So, pitch black. Convoy stuck in a kill zone, and it's just him and his wingman.
Just the two of them. John Larrison was his wingman. Dwell makes the point they never flew more than a two-ship at night. Too complex, I guess.
Okay, so challenges, darkness, just two planes. What about weapons? What did they carry for that kind of mission at night?
Yeah, the typical night loadout, he said, was frag bombs, you know, fragmentation, rockets, and white phosphorus. He called it whippet.
Whippet. White phosphorus. What's that do?
It's nasty stuff. He described it as a 100-pound canister of burning phosphorus, creates this huge, bright shower of burning particles, good for marking a target or suppression, maybe a smokescreen, very visible at night.
Gotcha. So he's talking to the ground commander, an army captain.
Yeah, captain on a radio saying they're in deep trouble. Dwell sees a vehicle burning, sees mortar rounds coming in. He's got to figure something out fast.
And this is where the tactics come in.
Exactly. His tactical thinking under fire. He tells Larrison the plan. He's going to drop the white phosphorus first, near where he thinks the enemy are, mark the spot, maybe make them keep their heads down.
Okay, so the WP marks the target.
And then Larrison follows him in, hits that marked spot with frag bombs. Then they just keep making passes, hitting the enemy positions again and again.
And this is where it gets really hairy, right? The proximity.
Oh, yeah. The ground commander is yelling on the radio, get closer, get closer. And after one particularly close drop, Dwell remembers the captain shouting, Jesus Christ, that's close enough.
Wow. I mean, that tells you how desperate things were down there, the trust involved.
That's incredible, isn't it? They're literally dropping bombs feet away from their own guys, and they trusted the pilots to get it right.
So after they run out of bombs, they're not done.
Not done. They switched to strafing runs, 20-millimeter cannons, 800 rounds each, just spraying the area.
And then he does something even crazier.
Yeah, this is wild. He turns his lights on. Think about that. Flying around at night, lights on, basically saying, here I am.
Why would he do that?
To draw fire. He figures if they shoot at him, Larison, his wingman, can see the muzzle flashes and then target them.
That is incredibly brave. Or maybe just nuts.
A bit of both, maybe. And right then, he says, a rocket whizzes right past his cockpit. Super close.
Jeez. What did he do?
His reaction apparently was pure John Wayne. He just deadpans down. How could I have possibly missed that? Just cool under pressure, doesn't even begin to cover it.
Unbelievable. And he calls that mission his only war story out of 270.
I know. It's kind of mind-boggling. It just shows you, I think, that this level of intensity, maybe not quite that extreme every single time, but intense combat was just the norm for them.
Right. It wasn't the exception. It was the job.
Exactly. And he talks about the conditions, too. The heat. So the cockpit could get up to 130 degrees Fahrenheit.
Brutal. Just physically draining.
Totally. But then he also says, almost in the same breath, that, you know, it was a lot of fun.
Fun? How do you square that?
Well, he explains it as, look, this is what we trained for. This was our job. There's this weird mix of adrenaline, focus, doing the job you were meant to do, even amidst the horror and danger. It's complex.
Yeah, very specific mindset, I guess. He shares some other interesting bits, too, right? Not just that mission.
Oh, yeah. Like being a second lieutenant during the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Okay.
And apparently he had the authority, the codes, everything to launch a nuclear-tipped rocket.
A second lieutenant with nuclear launch authority. That's terrifying.
Isn't it the weight of that?
Yeah.
He also talks a bit about the draft, about conscription. He clearly wasn't a fan, had sympathy for guys who were drafted into Vietnam and didn't want to be there, especially with the drug problems he saw.
Hmm. An unpopular war for many draftees. What about losses? Did he talk about losing planes and pilots?
He did. He mentioned the Sky Raider losses, the A1s, were really high in 65, 66. He attributes it directly to that close air support mentality. Last one to die wins, he called it, meaning you don't leave troops in contact no matter the risk.
Hmm. So they pressed on, even when it was incredibly dangerous.
Right. But he also points out, importantly, that not all losses were combat. Training accidents happen too, tragically.
Any difference between day and night losses?
Interestingly, yeah. He said they actually lost fewer aircraft on night missions, despite the dark, the bad weather, maybe less effective enemy anti-aircraft fire at night. Hard to say for sure.
Hmm. And he was involved in rescue missions too, the Sandy missions.
Yeah, he mentions being part of the very first Sandy mission into North Vietnam. Those were the dedicated rescue flights for downed pilots. He talks about how the call signs evolved for those missions.
And the danger involved in those.
Huge danger. For the downed pilot, obviously, but also for the rescuers, especially over places like the Ho Chi Minh Trail. He also mentioned the growing threat from surface-to-air missiles, SAMs.
Right, the SA-3 he mentioned.
Yeah, and also the SA-7 Strela. The heat-seeking, shoulder-fired ones. Yeah. He seemed surprised they hadn't been briefed well on the Strelas when they started showing up and, you know, taking planes down.
Wow, an intelligence gap there. Did he have any personal rescue stories?
He tells a pretty gripping one about rescuing his own flight leader. The guy had to bail out over the water.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Duell and his wingman circled, coordinated the rescue, but they were getting incredibly low on fuel themselves, had to make this really dicey landing on a short, kind of overgrown auxiliary strip.
Nerve-wracking. How was the flight leader afterwards?
Understandably stunned, Duell said. Just kind of out of it after the whole ordeal. He also clarified the call sign, Black Mariah.
Black Mariah.
Yeah, apparently that was an Army helicopter call sign, Spook helicopters, he called them, that also did rescues. Just another one of those details that paints the picture. He emphasizes how vividly these memories stick with you, you know, the combat stuff.
I can only imagine. So, shifting gears a bit, what about after the war? Did his connection to flying continue?
Oh, absolutely. His passion for aviation definitely didn't stop. He went into the petroleum industry, but the family stayed involved in flying.
And the air racing.
Yeah, he gets really enthusiastic talking about air racing, his Hawker Sea Fury aircraft. Big, powerful piston engine fighter.
Cool. He also mentioned a story about a Sky Raider at the very end of the war.
Incredible story. Some South Vietnamese pilots managed to escape by flying an A1 Sky Raider to Thailand. The amazing part,
Oh.
they crammed 19 people aboard that plane.
19 people in a Sky Raider. How is that even possible?
Desperation finds a way, I guess. A truly remarkable escape.
And he also had some high-level interactions after his tour, briefings and such.
Yeah, pretty significant ones. He briefed Secretary of Defense McNamara and the Air Staff Board in March 66, right after his tour.
What was he telling them?
Key concerns. He highlighted critical bomb shortages they were already experiencing and the need, the really urgent need for better search and rescue capabilities.
So feeding his direct combat experience right back up the chain.
Exactly. And even later, this is really fascinating, he worked with the RAND Corporation.
Rand, the think tank.
And he was involved in laying out the requirements for what would become the A-10 Thunderbolt II, the Warthog.
No kidding. He helped design the A-10.
Helped define the requirements for it. He specifically pushed for things he knew were needed from his F-100 days in Vietnam. The big gun, obviously, the GAU-8,
BRRRT.
the BRRT, and lots of armor plating around the cockpit to protect the pilot. Survivability was key.
Makes perfect sense, given what he'd seen.
Absolutely. He even suggested fold-up wings, like on Navy planes, to make it easier to transport or base. That idea didn't fly, but it shows his practical thinking. That direct link between Vietnam CAS experience and the A-10's design philosophy is really clear.
Did he ever fly the newer stuff, like the F-35?
He flew the simulator, and let's just say he wasn't entirely convinced about its suitability for the kind of down-in-the-weeds, close air support the A-10 excels at.
Interesting perspective. His experience wasn't just flying either, right? Staff jobs.
Right, he served on various battle staffs later in his career, NATO assignments. He worked with the RAF during the Falklands War. So, a really broad perspective on air power.
And he had thoughts on the A-10's future.
Yeah, he talked about the ongoing debates about retiring the A-10, the problems they've had with replacing wing spars on the existing fleet. He clearly still feels very strongly about its value.
But looking back, he seemed proud of his contributions.
Definitely, especially regarding search and rescue improvements and just his love for flying shines through. He mentioned the F-106 Delta Dart, the Interceptor, and the A-1 Sky Raider as his favorites. Still an aviator at heart.
So, wrapping this up, what are the big takeaways for you from this deep dive into Tom Dwell's account?
Well, first, just the sheer intensity of close air support in Vietnam, the danger, the constant pressure. It's palpable in his stories.
Yeah, you get a real sense of that. And the skill and, frankly, the bravery involved, his decision making in that night mission.
Incredible resourcefulness, wasn't it? Under unbelievable stress. And it also shows how that passion, that aviation bug, can last a lifetime and lead to really significant contributions even after the flying days are over, like with the A-10 requirement.
It really personalizes history, doesn't it? It's not just dates and battles, it's the individual experiences, the memories, the long-term impact on people like Tom Dwell.
Absolutely. And if this has piqued your interest, we really do recommend finding that full Military Tales interview, episode 63. There's so much more detail and context in the full thing.
Definitely worth seeking out.
And maybe a final thought to leave you with. Thinking about how air combat has evolved with technology, drones, stealth, all that, does the fundamental need for that close-in air support, that pilot willing to get low and slow to help troops in contact, does that need ever really go away?
That's a really good question. Even with all the tech, is there still a place for that human element, that courage, right there in the fight? Something to think about.